Welcome to The Commentary, a weekly conversation about vision, worship, and life at Grace Presbyterian Church. I'm Mark Bertrand. I'm a novelist and the pastor of Grace, and this is another of our special episodes featuring my colleagues at Worldview Academy. Last week, I talked with Jeff Baldwin, and today I have the pleasure of welcoming Worldview Academy's executive director, Mike Schutt. Mike and I started at Worldview the same week, and we've been friends ever since. He's a lawyer, a law professor, and the author of the book Redeeming Law. Mike also hosts the podcast Mindset. In this episode, I'm going to be asking Mike about two subjects I know he's passionate about, work and leisure. If there's anything we have more misconceptions about than work, it's got to be leisure. So we're going to tackle a lot of the myths. We'll talk about why work isn't a necessary evil and why leisure is not the same thing as idleness. Since Worldview Academy is Grace's mission of the month right now, our goal in this episode is to give you a sense of the kind of thing that Worldview does. Work and leisure are both great examples of that work because we never think about them just for the sake of thinking. We try to think rightly about work and leisure so that we can do work and leisure better. Let's start by asking Mike to weigh in on something I know he's not a fan of, the phrase work-life balance. Mike, I want to start by asking you a question about a conversation I recently heard you have on your podcast Mindset. You were talking to Myron Steves, and there was this phrase that came up, and both of you kind of chuckled over it and didn't really like that term. And the term was work-life balance. I hear that all the time. People are talking about how important work-life balance is. So I was just curious, what's your big problem with work-life balance?
I love the question. The big problem, of course, is that the question assumes that our work isn't actually our life, right? So that we're balancing work that we spend most of our lives doing with our lives, which is something detached from our work. And so that we're somehow supposed to balance our real life with our with something we call work. But when in fact, it's true that we were created to work. God made us to be workers, and not just in our jobs, but in the world and in creation and with other creators. And so work-life balance is just sort of it's kind of a red herring in lots of ways. And of course, what people mean is that your whole source of flourishing and your whole life before God is not simply made up of your 9-to-5 job or of a career, but that is just part of it, and all those things go together in your service before the Lord, including your job, actually. And so, to say that you're balancing those things is really unhelpful.
Do you think that people have bad ideas about work that lead to that feeling that work is something that needs to be balanced with real life?
Yeah, I do. And I think even some Christians would say, oh, work is a result of the fall. The reason that we work is because of sin, and work is just a result of the sin in the world and the result of the corruption in the world. But in fact, God created us to work. He placed Adam in the garden to work it and till it. Adam was working before sin came into the world, and our Heavenly Father is a worker. He is a creator. He made the world. He's not only a worker, but he's a rester. He's a non-worker. He's a stopper of working. And so he has set for us a model. And so part of our problem is we think somehow that work is an evil or a necessary evil, when in fact it's a good. It's something God created us to do. While it has been corrupted by the fall and by sin, that's not the whole story. Work is toilsome. Hoeing a garden requires now a fight against weeds and makes us sweat and toil. And that wasn't necessarily the case before the fall, and it is now. But work itself is a good thing. And I think that's one of the main misconceptions that we have about what work is, that keeps us or drives us toward things like, oh, work-life balance. It's this bad thing we have to do, and we're balancing it with all the other good things in our real life. And that's just a false dichotomy. Likewise, the sacred secular dichotomy, right? The dichotomy that says there's spiritual work in the world, and pastors like you, Pastor Mark, are doing real spiritual work, but lawyers and teachers and plumbers and architects and moms and dads, they're not doing spiritual work like pastors or elders or others who are doing spiritual Christian work. And so when we think about how Paul talks about whatever we do it in the name of Jesus. And he talks about all that we do should be done to the glory of God. And when we look at God's original plan for humanity as involving work and rest and rhythms, and that the things that we do with our hands as we create, the things that we do with our minds as we think, the things that we do in relationships, the things that we build, the things we take dominion over, all of these things are things that God has given us to do, and we can do those faithfully or unfaithfully, but he's created us to do them, and so we can do them to his glory. We can also do them badly and not to his glory, but we're created to do work to his glory. All of it is, in a sense, spiritual work then. It's all to the glory of God.
Okay, so really what we're talking about here is unlearning the way that we think about work. And so you've already said, rather than thinking of work as a necessary evil, we should recognize that work is a good. And you've also said that we should overcome that misconception that there's sacred work and secular work, and recognize that all work is good and God-given within certain boundaries, I suppose. Are there any other things that we need to unlearn or rethink if we're going to have a proper view of our work?
I do think so. There are so many times that we look at work and we say, we're doing this for God, or God really needs me to do this, or I'm doing this to help God do his work. When in fact, I think the thing that we need to unlearn is that we're sort of independent agents, and God's not currently at work in the world, and it's just us. And so I think it's helpful to learn that God uses us as his instruments. When he gives us vocations and callings, and when we use a word like vocation, which is from the Latin for to be called, for a calling. So when we think about the names of our callings, like pastor or teacher or lawyer or politician or mom or dad, when we think about those callings, it presumes there's a caller, that there's someone who's placed us in that. But I think we can go farther than just saying, God has called me to this work. He's created me to do it. He's asked me to do it. He's given this work for me to do. There's something a little bit more, and that is that he's using us as his instruments of his grace in the world. And so when I'm working with my hands, or I'm doing my job, or I'm loving my children, or I'm talking to my friends, or I'm doing most of the things that I do in the world, God is using me to carry out his work in the world. And so we're God's instruments, his tools to bring about his work in the world. And we do that self-consciously or not. I mean, he uses those who don't know him to do his work in the world, obviously. But to do that self-consciously, to say, oh, Lord, my work as a teacher, I should be teaching these people as if you are speaking to these people through me, and I'm just your instrument of blessing and grace as I'm teaching. But this is true even for auto mechanics and plumbers, knowing that God is creative. God serves and loves and pours out his grace. He reconciles parties. He lifts burdens off people. He frees victims. He unshackles the oppressed, right? He's doing all sorts of grace-filled work in the world. And as we work with our hands and our minds and our feet, we are his instruments of grace in the world. And I think that's something we don't think about very often. And I think that's part of unlearning, that we're just free agents and God needs us. No, God uses us. We're privileged to be used by God, and he's going to do his work one way or the other. So let's get well, let's say conscious of it, and ask him, what are you doing with the gifts that I have in the world? How can I love my neighbors? How do you want to love my neighbors through me?
Okay, so that does lead to what I think is a really important question. It's the practical consideration here that obviously, as a Christian, we ought to understand that God is working in the world and he works through us. And he does all of those things that you were just describing, but he doesn't do all of those things through me in particular, right? He only does some of them. And so that leaves me with the question of figuring out, like, what's the work that he's calling me specifically to do? And I think usually we approach that as like a young person's question, like, what should I do with my life? What occupation should I pursue? But it seems to me that increasingly it's an adult question as well, that throughout the course of a person's working life, especially today, they may have to ask and re-ask that question, what work should I be doing? So what I'd like to ask you is, let's say a two-part question. One is, how should we, as we think about work, think practically about figuring out our own particular callings? And also, what considerations should we have apart from just what pays the best?
Those are really good questions. And you're right, they're very practical. There's a sense in which sometimes we think too much of the choices that we have to make, and that we often think of ourselves as always deciding what I'm going to do and what I ought to be doing. And we sort of skip the step of, wait a minute, where has God placed me? What has God given me? And who are my neighbors? Right? And so if God is at work in the world, he's already at work. He was at work before we showed up. He's going to be at work after we're gone. And yet he's given us something to do now. And chances are good, before we ask the question, what should I do with my life? He's already doing something with it. We should start with, where has God placed me and what gifts has he given me? And how can I use those gifts to love the people that I find around me? We call those neighbors. And they're there by God's providence. And part of my determination of what I should do with my life depends on what I have that they need, because I know that God's created me with stuff, gifts, and talents for their benefit that he wants to pour out on them through me. And your point is a good one too, not just through me, but through everyone else in my community. We are always in a state of giving and receiving love and service by God's grace through other people that he puts in our lives. So first, I think we start with that. And then secondly, the practical matter is that knowing that God is sovereign, we know that we can rely on him to answer our prayers, to be used by him, to love our neighbors. And I think of the famous passage that we quote all the time out of Romans 8, 28, that all things work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to his purpose. And part of the meaning, part of the crux of that verse is that those who are called, he will direct to use the gifts that they're called to use in the context in which they're called to use them. And that doesn't mean we just sit around and wait for things to happen to us, but knowing that God is sovereign, we know that circumstances in our lives can actually help us determine our gifts and talents, the neighbors that we're supposed to love, the jobs we're good at, the jobs we're bad at, the places we can go for training, the places we can't go for training. Maybe we can't afford it or we can't travel. That God uses the circumstances and the context and really the things, the gifts that he's given us that are both limiting and expanding to help us determine how we use our gifts to love our neighbors. If we're asking ourselves, what do the people around me need? Or what do I have that other people can be blessed by? What has God given me that I can splash around on other people?
So if I look at my own gifts and I ask myself, like, how can I use these things that God's given me to serve others? Is it fair then to maybe look at the other side of that equation and see how I could approach work not looking to share, but looking to keep for myself or to serve myself?
The word that was coming to my mind was ambition. I think a lot of the way that we think about what work we want to do has ultimately to do with serving our own ambition to get ahead, to be more famous, to be wealthier, those kinds of things. Do you see a tension between using our gifts to serve others and using those gifts to serve ourselves?
There certainly is a tension, right? And it too, we are designed to love God. We're called and designed to love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love our neighbors as ourselves. So we are thinking of ourselves as well. And ultimately, right, being in the place where our God-given gifts and talents are used for their best purpose, and that is to love others, is going to be fulfilling, satisfying. There's going to be content. But sometimes we get in a position where we think, oh, I'm not passionate about that, or that doesn't really make me tick. And that's not always a good thing to think that our passion has to line up with the daily work that we do, or the service to our neighbors. Sometimes it's uncomfortable. Sometimes God calls us to do things that we're not good at, that we don't love, that we're not passionate about, and yet we still have duties in our calling. But it's also true that God has gifted us and loves us even in our work. And so to be ambitious in the sense of desiring to do our work excellently, to be better than we were yesterday at it, to hone the gifts and talents that he's given us to his glory, if that's the kind of ambition that we're talking about, I think that's a godly and righteous ambition to say, you've given me these things, and they don't come to us fully developed. He's given us aptitudes and bents and desires that he wants us to develop and to cultivate. It's part of taking dominion of the world. It's part of being disciplined to love and follow Jesus, is to develop those gifts. But ultimately, we know that there are gifts that we have in this sense. We hold those as stewards. I think of 1 Peter 4, as each has received a gift, use that gift to serve others as stewards of God's varied grace. Right? So we're stewards of the gifts. Peter says, these are gifts that we hold not for ourselves. That's what a steward is, right? A steward has something that's not his or hers, but he or she holds it for the benefit of someone else. So God gives us these. They're from him. They're to us, but they're for the benefit of someone else. And so we don't want to hoard those gifts and be ambitious in the sense of, hey, I have these gifts so I can get ahead in the world, or I can make more money. No, I want to use these gifts to love and serve others, and to make sure God's grace is being made known in the world through my words and my deeds.
I actually think that concept of stewardship is the perfect way to think about work and balancing the use of our gifts for others and our own ambitions and all of those different tensions that we're talking about. Because if we are zealous to be good stewards of what God has given us, then that shapes those ambitions in the right direction and prevents them from kind of going off into the direction of merely self-service. I think I've picked that up from you and have used it a lot myself as a way of talking about, you know, godly ambition and work, and how we do want to be zealous to use what we've been given and not neglect it. But at the same time, we want to be careful to use it in the right ways that glorify God. But it does raise a question, and I want to kind of transition here. We've been talking about work, but there's another topic related to work that a lot of us think about often, and that's leisure. A lot of people think of work as a means to an end, that we work so that we can have leisure, so that we can enjoy ourselves. And there's a quote from Aristotle that you introduced me to, and I want to ask you about this and maybe unpack this a little bit. I'm paraphrasing, but Aristotle says that both work and leisure are necessary, but leisure is higher than work or occupation and is the end to which that work or occupation is directed. So he's saying that we have to work, but we also have to have leisure, and that leisure is better than work. And leisure is the goal of work, if I'm understanding correctly. But is that right? I mean, are we basically working so that we can relax on the weekend? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Oh, I love that. I love that quote. And I love thinking about this question because Aristotle thought of leisure probably a little differently than we often think of it. But I think he, a philosopher and sort of philosophers through the ages, have thought of leisure as the pursuit of things that are useful in and of themselves. Right, rather than work being, you're doing things for the sake of other things. You're doing something to make something or to earn money, or there's a utility to it. But leisure is something there's no utility to. It's simply enjoying and chasing after things that are valuable in and of themselves, regardless of their utility.
What would be some examples of that?
Pursuing beauty, truth, and goodness would be how maybe Aristotle or a philosopher might frame it. But we might think of it as listening to music, painting, drawing, engaging in sports, reading for pleasure, watching a sunset, going on a walk that's not exercise, right? And maybe that's a couple good examples might be going on a walk for exercise. You're doing that to an end, but going on a walk just to enjoy walking and being outdoors is leisure. One is work, utility, and the other is leisure. So these similar activities can have sort of these dual purposes, but it helps point out what the point of leisure is, right? We eat in order to live, right? And so that's more like work, but we feast or have dessert for the pure enjoyment of it, for its own sake, for the goodness of it, for the taste of it, right? There's not a utilitarian end in sight. And so one thing, you know, Aristotle was saying that leisure is a high calling because it is something that human beings were made to do. There's something in human flourishing, or there's something about pursuing truth rather than falsehood, beauty rather than ugliness, goodness rather than badness, right? There's something in chasing after those things that contributes to human flourishing. There's something human and beautiful and good and true in pursuing those true and beautiful and good things. And so he would say this is a high calling, and it's such a high calling that, gosh, the reason we do ordinary work is so we can do this high calling of chasing after and considering as an intellectual activity truth and beauty and goodness, right? What the philosophers do, that must be the highest calling. But he, I think what Aristotle was missing, or I would say Aristotle was probably wrong, although far be it for me to actually say Aristotle was wrong, but bear with me. I think what he's missing here is our previous conversation about work, right? That work is a high calling. We are made to work. We're created to work because we're made in the image of God, who is a worker. Our creator is a worker. And so we work to his glory and as his instruments in the world. And so work is also a high calling, just as leisure is. And if we were to separate them out like Aristotle does, and I think we can, I think the utility, non-utility, or the I do something for the sake of other things is work, but I pursue things that are valuable in and of themselves, and we call that leisure. I think that dichotomy is okay. I think we can split them up like that. And if we were to split them up like that as Christians, I think we could say we were created to work, but we were also created to leisure. We were also created to pursue the good, the true, the beautiful for their own sakes, because they're valuable in and of themselves. And I think if we think about it for a minute, the reason we as Christians can say that Aristotle's right about those things being valuable in and of themselves is that our God is good. No one can be called good but God. Our Savior is a beautiful Savior. Our God is a beautiful thing, a beautiful being, and he creates beautiful things, right? Jesus called himself the truth. And so when you look at beauty, truth, and goodness, you're really saying these are beautiful and true and good things, are reflections of the true and beautiful and good God. And so it makes sense that we would be created to pursue God, good, true, and beautiful being, and also the things that reflect that goodness, truth, and beauty. And so I would say Aristotle's half right. Leisure is a high calling, but so is work. But we're not super good at chasing after leisure either, I would say.
So I think somebody listening to this might say, it sounds as if Mike Schutt and Aristotle, although they may disagree on what leisure is exactly, both talk about leisure in a way that makes it sound like a kind of work, that you are working at work and getting paid for it. So that's utility. And then leisure is work that you do. You just don't get paid for it. And you do it for its own sake. And I think if I'm reading the room correctly, people are going to want me to ask, okay, but what about like leisure? Like what about when I'm not pursuing truth, goodness, and beauty in some philosophical ideal way, I'm vegetating. I'm relaxing from work. Isn't that what leisure really is? In other words, is there a place for idleness, let's say, in this economy? Or do I always need to be working either at work or leisure?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's such a so well put and such a great question. And yeah, I mean, the snappy answer would be, well, yes, of course, vegging out is a sin, but that's not true, right? It's not true that just vegging out and being idle is necessarily a sin. On the other hand, the medieval theologians thought of sloth as one of the deadly sins. Right, the sloth of idleness, or what we would translate now idleness, and the Latin would be acedia or acedia, A-C-E-D-I-A, right? They would have called it, though, not just idleness, but a spiritual apathy that says, I don't want to be who God created me to be. Right. And so, and that actually is a sin. If your habit in your non-working hours, when your attention is not captured by the things you have to do with your hands to make a living or to be creating things, and you have time where you're not doing that, to say, well, God, I know I'm created to think about things that are good and true and beautiful, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to think about things that are bad and false and ugly. Or maybe in the middle, you're saying, I'm too busy to actually stop and pursue what's good and true and beautiful, to think about what goodness is and what and to enjoy the goodness and the beauty around me. I'm too busy for that. We call that workaholism, but the medieval theologians would have called that sloth, acedia. Sort of counterintuitive, but it's interesting because what you're saying is I can't do one of the things I'm created to do because I have overindulged my life in being busy and trying to be productive. And that could be because I don't want to stop and think about what's good and what's bad, what's true and what's false, what's beautiful and what's ugly, right? Sometimes if I'm working too much, it's because I don't want to stop and ask myself, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing the right job? Am I being a good husband? Have I been a good father? Am I being a good friend? And so I fill my life up with busyness so I don't ever have to stop and reflect on the world and reflect on myself and consider my ways, right? So that's the trap. And again, go maybe back to your example of vegging out or just being idle or just stopping, right? It's not a sin to take a nap or to sleep. The whole world isn't divided up into either working or leisuring. But I would agree with the people who are wondering, is leisure a kind of effort that I need to engage my mind and I need to engage with the world around me in a particular kind of way rather than just being distracted. Yes, it takes effort, and distraction and idleness are the enemy of true leisure.
Would you say that as humans, and maybe in particular as Christians, that we have a responsibility to order our lives in order to make room for that true leisure?
Yeah, I do. I do. In the same way, we do need to understand work rightly and then order our work lives towards thinking about being God's instruments of his grace in the world to our neighbors, I think we need to think well about our non-working time. What does rest look like? What does non-work look like? And can we order our lives around a reflective life, a life that includes things like contemplation and spiritual disciplines and study and a conversation with friends and enjoying and receiving the goodness of God's creation and thinking about our own lives and playing to the glory of God? Yeah, I do think we need to order our lives around those things in a much better way than we usually do, or at least than I usually do.
Well, I think that's helpful because a lot of conversations about Christianity and work are an encouragement to think more Christianly about work as a good and necessary thing and to see it as a way of serving others. But it kind of ends there, as if the way to renovate our lives is to work harder, but in the right way. And I do think we have a tendency to omit this other component. And I suspect it's because if we go down too far down this path of leisure, it starts sounding a little bit elitist, that we're encouraging people to build time into their schedules to not just spend time with family, not just read the Bible and pray, but also to contemplate beauty, to, read a great book or to attend a concert, a classical concert, maybe more so than a Taylor Swift concert, but we can talk about that. But right, like
or watch a sunset or count the birds in your backyard or absolutely.
So it requires, I think it requires us to push back against a very modern idea that anything that isn't popular is sort of elitist and pretentious, right? Because I think leisure understood this way is going to pull us into spending at least some of our time doing things that aren't just about consuming pop culture, but are about reflecting on higher things. And that presumes that there are higher things.
Yeah, it does. It does. When you think about taste, and anybody can like a soft drink. It's accessible. It's easy. It's not an acquired taste to drink a sugary, fizzy drink. Now, some people don't like them, but it's easy to understand the attraction, right? So you don't have to acquire a taste for Coke or Sprite generally, but coffee, which is a little more complex and has some variations or whatever, most of the time you have to acquire a taste for it, and you have to know a different kinds of coffee and not consciously study them, but tasting there are some complexities that help you acquire a taste for something that's a higher beverage, if you will, right? So same thing is true of beauty, I think. And you mentioned Taylor Swift. I think one reason Taylor Swift is the unusual pop artist that has some complexity and some thoughtfulness in the way that she writes. And yet anybody can listen to Taylor Swift and understand Taylor Swift. But there are higher forms of music, right? There are things that are more complex that require a little more work to understand. To enjoy a symphony, you have to listen probably to more than one of them and realize, gosh, there are parts, and these parts are doing different things, and there's no words, so I don't know what it's saying. So there's different kind of language I have to get used to. And so, yeah, if I'm going to listen to this kind of music, it's going to take me a little bit of attention, and it's going to require a little bit more of a cultivation of a sensibility to what's going on in this music. And I think one of the things we're called to do, and I'm not saying were called to move from Taylor Swift to classical music, all of us. But I'm saying all of us are called to thinking about what makes something good, what makes something beautiful, right? And there are things that are more beautiful than others. And right, the gazillions of gallons of ink have been spent on whether beauty is in the eye of the beholder or not. But it's clearly, there is some sort of objective standard of what is beautiful. That is God himself. And so we could spend a lifetime exploring the different kinds of beauty and whether or not there are different levels of beauty. And to dig into those things well and faithfully, I think, is the task of the human being. And specifically the task of the Christian who says that we serve a God who is good and true and beautiful in an ultimate sense. And the more we focus on good and true and beautiful things, the better we're able to point out to our non-believing neighbors that these are simply shadows and cheap reflections of the ultimate goodness, truth, and beauty, right? So there's a way to appreciate and receive creation that really helps us interact with the world, helps us point ourselves and others towards the true goodness, truth, and beauty, and is part of our flourishing as human beings.
Thanks so much, Mike, for joining us for this episode. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the commentary. If you've enjoyed this talk, rate us on your favorite podcast app and share the episode with your friends on social media. You can subscribe to the commentary on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. And you can find out more about us online and check out our other podcasts by visiting us at graceforsiouxfalls.org.